Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Archaeo Animals, the podcast all about zoo archaeology. I'm your host, Alex Fitzpatrick, and with me as always,
Simona Falanda.
And today is the last episode. Real sad, I guess. I don't know how popular this miniseries was, but let's say it was.
We'll decide it was very popular, just like our case studies. Absolute faves.
Our reality is what we make of it. Anyway, this is the last episode of our Time Warped miniseries, where we were basically going period by period, looking at the zoo archaeology there and how it may or may not have very characteristic things based on the period, all that fun stuff. But yeah, today's the last episode of it, and we are going to talk about the zoo archaeology of the medieval period. Now, right before we recorded, Simona did make a good point that technically there is the post-medieval, but, you know, who wants to do that?
Probably a post-medieval archaeologist.
Yeah, and you know what? They can make their own podcast.
But yeah, but I guess before we started off, as usual, I guess we'll discuss a bit more about what is the medieval period, because as you'll find out, it kind of depends. Of course it does.
Yeah, as I've said in previous episodes, if there's one running theme in this miniseries, it's that everything is arbitrary and subjective. So it's not very cut and dry, and it hurts my brain. And this is actually, while we were working on the notes for this episode, this is something I've literally never thought about. And again, I have just finished a PhD that took my work into the medieval period. So I don't know if that is a sign of me just being good at faking it, or my institution as being bad at catching really bad academics.
But either way, because of course we talk about, you know, what is meant by the medieval period in terms of date ranges. And as Alex said, it is very arbitrary because it's something that, you know, various scholars have come up with different dates, and usually they try to go for sort of a very significant event. But of course, you know, you do see like that there is such a thing as transitional periods, which I believe are very in archaeology these days. So
transitional periods.
Because of course, it's not like you get to a certain time, an exact year on a Wednesday under a full moon, and it's like, okay, it's the medieval period now. We're medieval peoples, everyone. But yeah, but I mean, like in terms of the medieval period, I mean, like even both the start and the end dates have sort of various dates that have been suggested by a variety of scholars. And so like for the start of the medieval period, it can either be the end of the Western Roman Empire, that's around 476 AD, which in a way would make it overlap with the previous episode that we've done on the zoo archaeology of the post-Roman period, because you start to see that distinction now as well. Or another date that's been thrown around is the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine to Christianity, which will take us to 312 AD, just much too early, if you ask me.
And it's funny to look at these dates because they do vary. It's not necessarily just people saying, oh, if we budget up like a decade or so. We're talking like 100 years and even more than that, if you ask English Heritage, which marks the start of the medieval period as 1066 after the Normans took over the previously Saxon England. That is, I think, much later than what I would have guessed.
Because again, it's something that it very much depends on sort of like the geographical and cultural context of the area that you're looking at. Because yes, once, you know, like the Roman Empire converts to Christianity, there is a major shift that takes place in the Roman period. But then that might not be necessarily be the case elsewhere. Now, I think with 1066, is well, if you have, you allow for that post-Roman period, which you've discussed in the previous episode, sort of like people almost picking up the pieces after the Romans left, the next major shift is the Norman invasion, because that profoundly changes the British Isles. It makes sense sort of as an arbitrary date. So I guess, again, it very much depends. I mean, in Italy, I think it is 476 AD that marks the start of the medieval period with the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. Because again, that profoundly changes what's happening in Italy. You get first sort of the shift between the Western and the Eastern Roman Empire. And that was quite a change in itself. And you do start seeing sort of invasions of various populations coming into Italy. But that all leads up to sort of the major sort of breaking point of 476, where the empire collapses. So it's just all a bit like, oh, what's going on now? That's the professional technical term. So I guess depending on the geographical region you're looking at,
yeah,
different arbitrary dates make the most sense. But I guess because we'll mainly be talking about British zoo archaeology, I guess we'll probably be going with 1066.
Yeah, I mean, I know that it is, that date is very specific to England. Again, this is, that's taken from English Heritage, which, if you can tell by the name, is mostly concerned with heritage in England. You know, just in case you didn't realize that.
That never clicked. Oh my.
I know. Who would have thought?
And also because, you know, otherwise we'll be repeating ourselves from the previous episode. So if you want to, like, hear about something that isn't Romans, but isn't quite the Normans either, there is all like a whole episode 38 for you to listen to.
There you go. I mean, and then of course we get to when does it end, because it obviously changes as well depending on who you're talking to, because we can't have nice things, can we? Generally speaking, the end of the medieval period is usually associated with the Battle of Bosworth, which was in 1485. But I believe, Simona, you said in Italy it's different.
Yes, in Italy, sort of, or that's what they teach you in school anyway. The end of the medieval period is marked by Columbus's first voyage to the American continent in 1492.
To be fair, I've seen that cited elsewhere, so I wonder if it's a wider European notion as well.
Well, because I guess because it's such, I guess, a long voyage that, like, I've never been attempted before, except it had.
Yeah, I mean, you know, opening up a route from the North American continent, or yeah, the Americas in general, to Europe is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, but, like, but that was never been done before.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, sure, Columbus. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, whatever.
But I guess because it was such a long voyage, that is a marker for the period of the Renaissance.
Renaissance.
Oh, I guess part of post-medieval period.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, there's other weird things to talk about. What about the Middle Ages? The Middle Ages, I think that was something, that was more of the kind of term you would use when you learn about the medieval period in America. Because obviously we really, like, we did not spend any time at all on anything medieval in the States when it came to learning about world history. I think maybe I had one grade year I got to, they covered it in class, and that was it. So I think Middle Ages was kind of the term they usually use, and technically it is also the same thing, but then some people use the Middle Ages to refer to the period right before the Renaissance. This period of time is incredibly confusing.
Because also I think there's yet another convention that puts, so it's divided between sort of the early Middle Ages, the high Middle Ages, and the late Middle Ages. Of course, like with the early going up until the year 1000 AD, and then you get the high Middle Ages until about 1250, and then you have the late Middle Ages that I think go around like 1500 AD. So again, I guess it roughly coincides with the other conventions that we discussed before. Because to be fair, you know, Battle of Bosworth, 1485, voyage to the Americas, 1492, 1500, they're not quite as wild as 312 AD to 1066. So they are a bit closer together.
That's fair. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I guess this is something we've also been talking about in this whole series is as we get more and more, quote unquote, modern, the time periods get shorter. They get a bit more specific. I mean, realistically, we weren't necessarily giving approximate dates down to like 476 in the prehistoric period. Those were way bigger ballparks of dates. But of course, as you get more specific, you end up getting a bit more convoluted in terms of, do we say the medieval period started in 476? Do we say it's 312? Also, what's the real difference? Let's be honest.
It had to be on a Wednesday on a full moon.
Yeah, because as you said, you know, this isn't something that they had like a New Year's Eve party and woke up the next day in the medieval period, which to be fair, I think we should do. But, you know, all these periods are just something we're applying from the future or their future to the past. And it is arbitrary because if you went back in time to someone in 476 versus someone in 312 and you were like, oh, do you feel very medieval? They'd be like, are you a witch? You know what I mean? Like, they'd be like, what does that mean?
Yeah, no, I mean, they are very much arbitrary dates and terms that is for ease of discussion. So I guess, you know, if I tell you about, you know, something cool they found from a medieval site, you know, instantly sort of roughly which date ranges I'm talking about. Or as we said earlier, you know, oh, there's this Iron Age site and you're like, oh, okay, so it's within these date ranges. So you have a fairly good idea. So it gives you context.
Yeah, for sure. And at the end of the day, like any context is good context, especially with archaeology, because you're lucky to get any context. We take stuff like dating for granted, but some things can't get dated. Some things are just too degraded. And sometimes you really just kind of have to guess. And it's nice to get these more specific dates. And then you can say, oh, this is actually more medieval. This is actually more Iron Age. And of course, if you find something so different from what you normally expect, that's a huge deal. So just kind of having those arbitrary points of time, as well as the kind of characteristics, again, very arbitrary, that you associate with each period is ultimately better. But for people like me who overthink things, it can be a lot to take in.
Yeah, because again, as you mentioned before, like the forward we go in time, as everyone must have noticed, the shorter and shorter these sort of time periods are getting. I guess with the advent of the written record as well, we do know a lot more about these populations. So we know more about changes that were profound and otherwise, the profound and the mundane, that we don't know about, say, Iron Age cultures.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you have those dates, so you can say, we know that there's a huge change coming with the fall of the Western Roman Empire, and we can start a new period of time from there. Whereas in the Iron Age, we don't have that written record. Everything that we say about the Iron Age, for the most part, is still very interpreted. We don't have written records saying this battle happened at this point. We can kind of infer it based on, you know, slightly older texts that may invoke about a past that is pre-written record. We may kind of get it from oral traditions or monuments and stuff like that, but we don't have the actual information. So we're kind of just guessing and basing it on characteristics of artifacts and traditions that we can interpret from the sites. And this is getting really deep, but I guess it is our last episode for this arc that we're doing, so we might as well.
I mean, I guess like what you have to do, like with the absence of a written record, is that you have to group, yes, similarities in terms of material culture and what the settlements look like. And of course, you know, it's never going to be 100% accurate because we're giving these ancient populations names, you know, like the Latin culture. And they're like, we have no idea what they call themselves.
It feels kind of rude sometimes.
Just this idea, okay, this is your name now.
The poor beaker people.
It's because she named it after pots. We didn't actually even like those pots. It just like one did some zigzags on them and like and it took off and became a fad and everyone was getting those. It was very annoying.
Yeah, but I guess it is ultimately what you have to sacrifice. You know, it's the dream to be able to be so precise and so confident in saying we have absolute proof that, you know, X, Y, and Z happened here. But that's not how archaeology works. So you do have to make these kind of concessions. And sometimes that's just saying, yeah, we're going to just have to like group all this together and say this is probably something happening in conjunction with each other as a passed around tradition, as a kind of local stylistic flair. And we don't know that. It could just be one weirdo going around all these sites dropping off pots that everyone else hates, and they're throwing them in the midden because they're like, we don't want this zigzag pattern. It's awful. And of course, here are we, like thousands of years later, going, oh, it must have been the local wear, like the local style. They must have loved this. They must have treasured this. And meanwhile, back then, they're like, that dude is so annoying. And
it's the worst.
We've told him like 10 million times, we don't want your pots. We're going to throw them in the midden, because they called it a midden back then as well. But, you know, again, we don't know. So, and I guess that's kind of the nice thing about archaeology, and something I like as someone who makes mistakes all the time, is that it's full of mistakes. The whole idea of archaeology is working on past preconceptions and making them more and more refined. So I look forward to someone who looks at my work in like 10 years, 20 years and goes, she was absolutely wrong. This is actually more accurate, because that's a good thing at the end of the day.
It just moves forward. And at the end of the day, it's the study of people made by people.
Yeah.
But yes, as I said, like, just arbitrary terms all around, but it just, it just makes it easier to discuss things.
Yeah. Our jobs are already really hard. Okay. Well, I mean, I don't excavate anymore, but other people's jobs are really hard already. So you might as well take it slightly easy when you can.
Yeah, I don't either. I've also hung up my trowel, so.
Yeah, we shouldn't bury our trowels. I don't know. I don't know what's going with that.
I did some digging a couple weeks ago. It was good fun.
We have one person who's still digging. Do you want a war?
I mean, look, I'll tell you how kind of out of it I was. I did 2 days barely at the weekend, and afterward, my hands, my knees were so, so sore. I was like, oh God, I am really not cut out for this. So anybody in the field, like, I feel you, you're doing an amazing bang up job, because I don't know if I could do it. So just want to say you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
Couldn't do this without you.
And as we, you know, salute our comrades in trowels and trenches, which would be a great title for a podcast, just putting it out there. Someone send me like 50 quid for that. I think we'll take a break.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back with Archaeoanimals. We are talking about the zooarchaeology of the medieval period, or the Middle Ages, or whatever you want to call it. It's apparently fair game. But we will be talking a bit more about what was actually happening in the medieval period and kind of what we were saying in the previous segment. As we get into these later periods, things are getting a bit more finessed and intricate, and we see that with the crafts and industries, for sure.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit more streamlined, isn't it?
Yeah, they have the ability to do it. So, you know, many of the crafts and industries are becoming much more specialized. I mean, we kind of talked about this idea of specialization in our last episode on the post-Roman period. But now it is extremely streamlined and specialized, especially as you see guilds and more distinct trade positions, you know, apprenticeships, things like that are being developed. And alongside this, we're also seeing urbanization, which is happening at a much larger scale.
Yes, you also see some interesting changes. What interesting? Interesting to some changes in the agricultural system, as one of the main sort of features that gets developed around this time period is the ridge and furrow system, which is, I think I discussed it before, is as you expect, you get a ridge and you get a furrow. So that was how largely crop was cultivated. And it does tend to be the bane of all, at the very least, field archaeologists, unless you're really into furrows.
I thought you were really into furrows, to be honest. I thought it was Romans and furrows, your two faves.
Oh, look at that headland. Oh, majestic. No. The headland is, because of course you'd have fields with the ridge and furrow system, and then sort of where they would meet, you'd create what is called a headland. But yeah, the thing with the ridge and furrow system is that the furrows in particular do a spectacular job at trashing all the archaeology underneath. So it'd be like, oh, look, it's a preserved mosaic surface furrow. Trashing half of it.
It's pretty inconsiderate, to be honest. You'd think they'd be like 1,000 years or so. Someone will want to look at this. So might as well keep it nice and just do the furrow around it.
But they'll be like, we can keep this preserved for future generations, or we can eat.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
They probably didn't even know it was there. Like, imagine the surprises. And so they were plowing through the furrow, and there'll be just like random bits of bone coming out. And look, they're like, what? But yeah, ridge and furrow is a very sort of, you'll find it throughout the medieval and the post-medieval period. All the rage in Britain. It's not something you see so much where I'm from, because, of course, Britain is quite flat in general, so it lends itself quite well to this type of system, while where I'm from, it tends to be more terrace, because, of course, we all mostly dwelled on the sides of hills and mountains and whatnot, so, yeah, ridge and furrow wouldn't quite work.
Not with that attitude. We have these specializations, but even as different as these crafts industries are getting, you still have your basics when it comes to species, your usual domesticates, sheep, cows, pigs, horses. Wool in particular was very important post-Norman takeover with regards to building up the wealth within England. And as it became one of the main British products, you'll obviously expect to see that mortality pattern within zooarchaeology at this time.
In order to produce wool, I mean, you tend to find quite older sheep, as it's sort of, you know, you keep them alive for as long as possible and you shear them over and over and over again. Well, of course, just as a quick aside, as a reminder, like if the sheep was to be used for meat, you'd see them probably being butchered either as a juvenile or a subadult stage. Mm-hmm. Or for milk, then you might see like a high rate of infant mortality as they want to exploit the milk instead.
Basically kind of the same thing you were seeing in previous periods, maybe at a more intensified scale, especially at a larger scale, as it became one of the main British products. But, you know, some things don't change, really. And pigs, too. Pigs were still considered high status. You also get to see some differences in high status meals. You're seeing more birds, a lot of game, fowl, partridges, swans, things like that being eaten. And fish become important. If anyone remembers from our Iron Age episode, we talked a bit about how there may have been a bit of a taboo against eating fish because we see so little fish in the archaeological record. But as we see the population become more Christianized, fish become very important to diet due to fasting days, because obviously, if you don't know, fish were okay to eat.
That's something that has always boggled my mind, because I think it's still the case to these days where, like, fish are okay to be eaten on fasting days because they're not meat.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I tell myself whenever I'm eating loads of fish, that it doesn't count towards calories or anything because it's not meat. Yeah, it's like fasting. It's fine.
I mean, you hate fish anyway.
Yeah, that's why I avoid ever writing about them in my faunal reports. It's because they're not meat, obviously. So they're not important. For people listening, I do write about fish in my follow reports, just saying, because I am going to be open for consultation soon. So please don't hold that against me. I will write about fish.
I mean, also, like, we do see, as you said before, yeah, we do see an increase sort of in fish consumption in the medieval period. So, of course, some of that might be due, of course, to, you know, like rules around religious fasting days. But also, like, you seem to see a shift in terms of what kind of fish is being consumed as to what sort of before around the 11th century, you tend to see a lot more freshwater fish being consumed. That kind of gets replaced by marine fish instead, which, I mean, it could be due to a number of reasons that have been argued by just as many scholars. Because, I mean, like, overfishing is one of the main ones, pollution of the habitat of freshwater species, as well as fishing restrictions. And I mean, like, we'll get into a little bit into that a little bit more as well when we get to hunting. But of course, laws start to get introduced which forbid people from fishing from certain ponds and water sources, because it's something that's very much sort of relegated to the upper classes. But in a way, freshwater fish becomes high status.
Yeah, it is really interesting how, and this again, this is something that begins to become more apparent and more of a factor, although it could have also been a factor in the past, but we have more proof of it in text for these later periods, the idea of having laws that literally change the way our archaeological contexts end up being. Because obviously, if you do have laws forbidding or restricting fishing, then it's going to completely change your average, you know, midden and things like that. And it's something that I think, especially as someone who mostly does prehistoric archaeology, you never really think about. And like I said, obviously, that could be something that we're just not really seeing yet doing prehistoric archaeology, but it's much more of a force in these later periods and much more of a factor to consider when you're looking at the composition of zooarchaeological assemblages.
Yeah, because also like it links back to like how we mentioned that there's a lot more birds, but like game birds, like partridge and swan and such that do tend to be more high status, again, because laws were also introduced in terms of hunting. So where people of lower classes could no longer go around and catch their own food. No, that was something for the upper classes to go have some fun and ride their horse and go, la, 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 I'm hunting all the animals, as you do. So there was very much hunting going on, which I guess we can roughly divide between sort of a hunting of edible and inedible prey. So the first being sort of for food and the second for sport, but arguably both for sport because you can. Because medieval upper class. So, of course, in terms of edible, the main ones that come to mind are deer and wild boar. Speaking of deer, we see a second introduction of the fallow deer.
Our fave, or one of our faves.
During the Norman period. I mean, as we've discussed, to no end, there is sounding like a broken record. But we do know, thanks to some really good research put forward by Naomi Sykes.
We love you, Naomi.
There was a first introduction of fallow deer during the Roman period, which sort of led the numbers dwindling as the Romans left, population likely not large enough to sustain itself. We do see a second reintroduction of the fallow deer by the Normans, again, probably much like the Romans, going like, oh, no, I hunt fallow deer back home, not this red deer thing. So over the fallow deer comes back, largely kept in deer parks, owned by the upper classes who would hunt them for food and probably sport because they can. And it is actually from this deer that our current population descends.
Yeah, all thanks to upper class snobbiness.
But one thing that I guess they did that wasn't so good was overhunting the wild boar to extinction.
Yeah, so on one hand, you have the creation of a huge population of species. And on the other hand, you have the destruction of a species up until extinction.
Well, you need to balance things. You know, it's an exchange. Here comes the fallow deer, wild boar. Aww. I mean, the wild boar technically doesn't go extinct until the 1600s, I believe. That takes us into the post-med period. But still, it was hunted in likely very large numbers. So by the time you got to the post-medieval period, there probably weren't enough to sustain a healthy population anyway. And then they just got obliterated because it's just, we're going to see a lot of this trend.
Yeah, well, you know, it's that exorbitance, that excesses that you get as you become a very highly stratified society. And at least the boars will always be remembered in that I do have a 5th century boar skull in my office right now. And I also have it tattooed on my arm. So I represent them and remember them.
Well, but yeah, we will see that a bunch. But, you know, like, it's not all bad. Wild boars are back in the British Isles. No one meant for them to be, but they are back. And they will take their revenge. Because wild boars are very angry animals. They will take their revenge.
I think they've already started to. Anyway, we also have the inedible. So the ones that are mostly hunted for sport. I mean, technically, you could probably hunt some of these for their hides, but they're just hunting them because they're a bunch of rich meanies. Because this list includes foxes, badgers, and otters.
Then why would you do that?
Exactly. Why would you do that? It's extremely... Ugh, I get it. I would have been part of medieval PETA, I think.
So we've gone from insulting fish to insulting, like, the medieval gentry.
You know what? I don't feel bad about insulting the medieval gentry, to be completely honest. Now, there's a special mention, wolves, which kind of fall into both categories because they were often hunted for fur, but they're also hunted for more of a important reason for protecting your livestock. At least that's how they saw it.
And you've guessed it. They get also hunted to extinction.
Oh, wow. And you know what? There's another one coming up. Bears also went extinct. We did it, folks. Good job.
Just obliterated all of the wildlife. Now enjoy that blue tit. The sound.
I mean, as you can tell, I don't know if you've noticed, hunting was basically an upper class thing at this time. And it also included the use of tamed / domesticated animals. That includes horses, dogs, and falcons and hawks, which are obviously becoming more of a thing around this time. So man's cruelty knows no bounds in the medieval period, and it's going to get worse. Because we got to talk about the exotic creature trade, at least briefly. As we get to the medieval period, the trade routes are starting to open up. We're starting to see more exotic creatures. Now, we've talked a little bit about exotic creatures. Actually, we talked a lot about exotic creatures back in our episode about them. I don't think we talked as much, though, with regards to exotic creatures in the medieval period. But basically, they were being bought and put in menageries and zoos, and they included creatures such as monkeys, camels, lions, leopards, all things like that. And as you know, that probably went over really well. They were definitely treated with respect in the medieval period.
Sure. Whatever helps you sleep at night.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't add it to our show notes, but I also saw that in, like, medieval France, they would put animals on trial in the medieval period. And there's this pretty gnarly picture someone drew at the time, not now, at the time, of a monkey being punished with the death penalty in France.
For what crime?
I don't remember what the crime was, but this was the thing that was happening with exotic creatures, it seems like.
What heinous crime might have this poor...
Who knows? But we can end on a nicer note.
Yes, maybe it's the one that went lost. We talked, like, several episodes ago about, I think that was sort of in the Roman period, of that landlord that told sort of his servants to make sure that no one climbed the walls into his house and told him, you know, like, I will not accept any excuses, just I've lost my monkey. Because apparently that was an excuse back then. So yeah, maybe it was that monkey that just went off walkies and that was the heinous crime.
Poor monkey. But anyway, we can end this section on a bit of a positive note, or not really a positive note, more of a whimsical note, because we can talk about bestiaries and they're just fun, you know?
Bestiaries, but also like all the sort of various monsters drawn on medieval maps.
Yeah, I mean, they're based on earlier texts such as Physiologus, is that how you pronounce that? It's waiting for you to say it.
Probably.
Yeah, which was written in Alexandria during the 2nd or 3rd century. These were manuscripts that would use animals as part of Christian allegories. But more importantly, especially for us looking back at them, they included descriptions of the animal as well, with some pretty hilarious illustrations most of the time, because all this stuff was based on word of mouth or other written texts. A lot of the people who were writing these bestiaries weren't traveling. So they would hear third hand, fourth hand, what, say, a lion looks like. And they'd try and draw it, you know? And it would serve as the image of these more exotic creatures for the average Joe Schmo on the street up until the time, if ever, that they saw it personally. And that's extremely hilarious and really interesting to think about.
Yeah, but what of the cats riding the snails? What was that meant to be?
You're telling me you've never seen a cat ride a snail? I see that every day of my life.
Oh, I guess you were focused on them when the squirrels were walking around in the park.
I thought you'd forget about that. Someone draw me what a squirrel looks like. I have no idea, apparently. Anyways, I mope about that. We'll take a break. I'll return with the case studies, which will be squirrel-free.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back with our favorite part of Archaeoanimals, except it's only us that say that and no one else who listens to our podcast. But it's the case studies. I feel like it's probably someone's favorite, so it tracks.
Seriously, we're fishing for this compliment. Like, someone, please.
Just say it. Just say it. Say it now.
You don't even have to mean it at this point.
No. Just say it out loud while you're listening to this episode at this point. Say, my favorite part of the show is the case studies. You are correct, Simona and Alex. And it'll validate us. And that'll be great. And I'm fishing for more validation because our first case study is, again, my PhD. And I promise this is probably the last time I'll mention it, at least in this detail, because as we draw further and further away from me completing this PhD, I will probably start to forget what actually was in the PhD, but we might as well talk about it now. So yeah, we did talk about it actually in a previous episode, but it's a weird one. So I figured we should talk about it again because it's not just later prehistoric. It is up until the post-medieval for some reason. We literally didn't know this. Fun fact, I started my PhD and did the first 3 years of my PhD thinking this was a later prehistoric site, and it is a later prehistoric site. And December 2019, a few months before, 7 months before I was supposed to submit my PhD, I got results back from a pretty decent chunk of our site. We finally got some dates back. They were all medieval and post-medieval.
So what, was there no pottery?
No, it's there's very few pottery in these sites. It's mostly organic material. So, and then I cried.
It's like all the C14 came back and it was like, ah.
Literally they sat me down and went, don't panic. And I was like, well, that's a great way to get me to start panicking. It turns out fine. If anything, there's some stuff that I kind of wish I had more time to work on, because obviously I spent 3 years of my life studying the later prehistoric and getting very familiar with that. And as you've seen with this series, the later prehistoric and the medieval period are extremely different in a lot of ways. So it was definitely an interesting time. But turns out it was very fascinating part of my PhD, so kind of worth it in the end. Probably the more interesting part in total.
Well, I guess it's quite good for the purpose of the case studies as well. You get to see the site evolving. So as we're talking about how there's differences in the way the animals are exploited throughout time periods, to have sort of a site, particular site as a control almost, it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing too. And it's something that it's more obvious when you're stepping away from it. Obviously, when I was kind of head first into all this, I noticed there was something strange going on in some of these contexts. But, you know, it could be you're finding a new kind of ritual or tradition that you didn't know of. And unfortunately, the later prehistoric in Scotland is still very not under-researched, But still, there's a lot of gaps in the way we understand it. So anything could have been, you know, something that we just never had come across until now. But looking back, obviously, you kind of are just like, yeah, of course that was medieval. Anyway, so for those who may have just started listening to this episode and missed all the other episodes where I talked about this, I did research on the Cowsey Caves, which were a series of cave sites on the Moray Firth coast in northeast Scotland. It's a very strange assemblage of human and animal bones, likely funerary rites and rituals happening, and it spans the Neolithic to the post-medieval. At least that's what we know right now. Because the other thing is that our research is very preliminary. This was like the first real excavation and analysis work. 5 years down the line, someone else excavating that could come up with even more dates in either direction. And like I said, this medieval part was a huge surprise. But anyway, it turns out to be an extremely interesting surprise. So it had the smallest amount of anthropogenic modification among all the phases. All these other phases, the late Iron Age, the Bronze Age, you saw so much bone being butchered. And that kind of connected to this idea of, you know, you had probably funerary traditions going on. You had ritual consumption of food, but now we're not getting anything. So prior to knowing this was a medieval part of the cave, I would have just assumed nothing was going on here. But it had the most amount of faunal bone identified. And a lot of it was probably natural deposits because these are cave sites. You're seeing birds and little critters go in. But there was actually a lot of domesticates as well, including probably the most interesting one was crane. I remember my supervisor coming in after excavation, handing me a baggie with a bone in it saying, oh, we found human. And I looked at it and was like, that's a big bird bone. Because it was like, it's like a foot long, this crane tibia. And it wasn't a complete tibia either. And I can understand why you'd think it's human, but it was a really big crane. So you have some really weird stuff going on here. Fish included cod, halibut, herring, wolffish, saithe, gurnard. Bird included domestic fowl, crane, of course, goose, puffins, great auk, wood pigeons, cormorants, Manx shearwaters, herring gulls, curlew. 65% of the assemblage was bird. And then your mammals, you had cattle, pig, sheep/goat. I didn't differentiate. There was too much going on. Red, fallow, and roe deer. Canids and felids, which we weren't sure if they were wolves and wildcats or domesticated dogs and domesticated cats. Hare, gray seals. It was literally, I thought this was like a petting zoo. It's just too much going on. And the crane was its own interesting thing, as it was in a feature that contained human teeth and pottery. But earlier pottery, like early Bronze Age pottery. And there were no butchery marks, though. So was it a ritual deposit? Was it not? Domestic fowl was often used in medieval folk rituals. So we ended up with two weird interpretations, but are kind of cool. So you have witchcraft, like tinkers living in caves, weird hermits living in caves trying to do witchcraft. Again, there's all these human bones that they would have been able to find. So it might have been some weird, like, oh, this looks like it's a cool place to try and do some weird witchcraft. And also there's cats everywhere. And then the other thing is it may have just been an early Christian use of caves, because you gotta exorcise them pagans out. And there's a very early Scottish tradition of Christians going to caves that were used by the Picts beforehand. And they would carve crosses. They would do their own rituals to, quote unquote, keep these spirits, these pagan spirits in the caves. So we don't really know what was happening, but boy, does it sound exciting. and that's probably the more non-typical medieval thing that you'd see when it comes to the zooarchaeology of the medieval period.
Yeah, but that's all very, that's all very odd.
It's a lot going on. You can understand why I was having like a nervous breakdown during my PhD.
I mean, it's also like, probably going to ask a lot of silly questions because I don't know the next thing about cave sites and sort of how the stratigraphy works on a cave site. But because you mentioned something, so your crane bone associated with human remains and Bronze Age pottery.
Yes.
So if we exclude the fact that the beaker man came in and started throwing his pots around there as well, which we know is the most likely explanation.
Yeah, of course, yes.
I mean, the Bronze Age pot, because the crane bone you said was medieval.
Yeah.
As it came back from the C-14.
Yes.
But the pottery was Bronze Age. Was that definitely deliberately placed in there, or was it residual?
It was in a cut deposit, I believe. And I believe the human bone was also early Bronze Age. So it's a weird site because it is a cave site and it's very constrained, but you also have small burrowing creatures also living there. So there was this case of just, you would have a Neolithic context, but you would find Iron Age context in terms of, you know, I would find fallow deer in a Neolithic context. And we know that that's probably not happening. So it's a lot of movement of animals, but also these caves were being reused over such a long period of time. That's people were just coming in and out. And you can even see it. There's a passageway that leads to the deeper cavern. And you can see that that's where you get all the mixed deposits because people keep walking in and out of it and lightly grabbing stuff that they're finding because there was a point where you could probably just see the human bone lying around.
Well, yeah, because you wouldn't have had, it wouldn't be as exposed in terms of natural siltation or anything because it was just in a cave, they're not as exposed. So I guess you got a combination of cut features, but also mostly just occupational layers.
Yep.
More than anything. Oh, dear.
It's literally, if you're a stratigraphy person, you will have a nightmare looking at this thing. It is so complex. And no wonder why it's still very early days on looking at this. Because again, it's reuse. It's just laying there. You have people reusing things as well. And it's an open cave, too. You could just go. So it's simultaneously confined, but also open for anyone to come in. So, yeah, it's so much of it has been a nightmare, but it's also very interesting. Just a lot to untangle.
Not to take in. I kind of want to see that Matrix now.
Oh, I might send you it. I think I have one somewhere, and I looked at it and went, I don't understand this, and I won't understand it. It's not really important to my PhD per se, because I would just kind of get told what it meant. I'm a zooarchaeologist.
Yeah, because I guess all you'd want really is to have sort of your quantified, sort of identified elements, group of phases more than anything.
Yeah, I just wanted the general spatial idea. I didn't, but I mean, I remember I was at least there for one day of excavation, and it's just even now, it's still kind of just tripping over human bone.
Oh, not unsettling at all.
Yeah, that's fine.
But yeah, and also all the domesticates as well, because you said there's no evidence of butchery marks.
Nope.
Anything taphonomical, bite marks?
I mean, that's the thing, is there were loads of cat gnawing. So my gut feeling, because again, we haven't been able to get this confirmed by ADNA because bad ADNA results. My gut feeling is that the dogs were domesticated, the cats were wild. And the cats were living in the cave for the most part. But I don't really have any other evidence to back that up, but that's my gut feeling.
Yeah, because I guess, it's difficult to make any inferences if there's no, taphonomic marks on them. But then you'd almost, if they're not butchered, you're almost inclined to think that that cave had been sort of reused by animals that were bringing prey into the cave.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that you couldn't say the domesticates were wandering in themselves because it is hard to get into the cave, but a cat could easily get into that cave on its own. And the other thing is that the cat being kind of the key component works for both interpretations. Cats in the medieval period, of course, they were already kind of being seen as a nuisance. They were their skins were used a lot. They were also associated at times with devilry. So either you have the witchcraft component, or you have this early Christian, we need to do rituals to keep the devil and the cats at bay.
Well, I was more thinking in the terms of it being a den for animals that would bring, they would attack livestock and then bring bits of livestock back into the cave as well. But it's just, again, you don't have any tooth marks to prove that. It's interesting and frustrating.
Yeah, that is basically the entire story of the PhD. But what we can talk about is our second case study, which is, I feel like, is also kind of frustrating because it's a very long kind of debate that's been going on, but a bit more research has been done on this, and that is rats. That's how it's written in our show notes. Rats.
Like six rats. Oh no, that's way more than six. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight A's.
And we are going to dedicate this section to David Orton because he is the rat man. Literally, he is at Medieval Rats, I believe, and is currently doing a lot of this, you know, preliminary work on black rats in Europe and the black rat introduction. This is cutting edge.
Yeah, there's some very recent references that you've managed to put together for this one.
Preprints. We never use preprints on this show, but gosh darn it, we're going to use it for this. Because it's, which is funny, because this is something I think everyone kind of knows as like a theory, but there is still very recent research being done on it, which is if you ask someone about rats, like in history, they'll probably bring up the plague.
As you do. And I guess it's one of those cases, yeah, but kind of, but also no, but yeah, no.
You know, rats and mice are basically linked to humans. They are basically how they spread around the world is they hitch a ride with us. And on one hand, that does make them very interesting to look at from a archaeological and historical perspective, because you can kind of use them to track and analyze movement and events and migration, trade, all that stuff. And obviously the big one, the real big one, is plague.
Rats, I guess, and mice as well, are sort of a species that we like to call commensals, how it is you pronounce it, because they do dine at a table. Not that we particularly want them there, but I guess we do. They share the same living space as humans.
Yeah.
They're not quite like synanthropic species that couldn't survive without humans, but we're sure quite handy to have about.
Exactly.
That makes sense. They'll probably be just fine without us, but they're even better if we're about, you know, eating our grain and pooing on our saucepans and...
Yeah, exactly.
And all that. Not just the cheese, you know, that's a stereotype. Not just the cheese. Don't go for anything. They're not fussy. But of course, black rats, which I guess is what we'll mainly focus on in this case study, in Europe at least, are mostly linked to the development of urban settlements and trade routes. So of course, we see several sort of introduction events, if you will, or moments at which the population is highest. So you have the first phase. You've guessed it, during the spread of the Roman Empire, so between the 1st and the 5th centuries, and then sort of the numbers again dwindle down a bit, and then you sort of see them again coming back in full force as medieval trade routes are established, and I guess more consistently from the 9th century onwards. Now, historically, black rats have been considered to be key in the spread of various plagues and diseases, you know, among which, but not limited to, the 6th century Justinian Plague, and the 14th century Black Death. However, I think this is kind of a hotly debated topic as to whether black rats are actually to blame for this. And I guess the jury's kind of still out, but also isn't, as in, I mean, they probably didn't help, but it also likely wasn't their fault either. Because looking at plague, more than likely it was spread by humans themselves through trade and movement around the continent, which of course was facilitated with the help of lovely, lovely body lice and fleas. Yay! So, but leave the black rat alone a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's not just simple. You don't want to simplify it to something. And obviously, and you know, obviously, and unfortunately, I think a lot of this kind of misconception of black rats being to blame for something like the Black Death has resulted in kind of some very negative feelings about rats to begin with, which we see today in terms of seeing them as very unclean and plague ridden and things like that.
Which they're not.
No, like, they're not.
Most rats are not unclean.
Yeah, it's humans that are the disgusting creatures of the earth that we should be concerned about, as we've seen in recent times, let's be real.
And as we've seen in this entire episode.
Yeah, it was probably the medieval gentry that brought the black out, let's be real. That's my hot take. There you go.
Change my mind.
Yeah,
But if you were wondering where black rats originally came from, because of course that in Britain, it is they were likely from Southeast Asia. And so they came sort of into the Mediterranean and then spread some more through Roman expansion, as we discussed, and then later in medieval expansion, urbanization, and creation of further trade routes.
Ain't that just the way? And I think that ends our Time Warped series, our mini-series, and this episode. Hopefully you enjoyed this little mini-arc thing that we did. I think we have another one coming up, so if you didn't enjoy it, well, tough. Don't know what to tell you.
You get another one.
You get another one, which you'll see, I guess, in a couple episodes, I think. You have a break before then, so you can listen to the next couple episodes and then stop listening.
It'll probably be next year anyway.
Yeah. But seriously, though, don't stop listening because we need your support. We would like it if you would like and subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. We're also on Facebook. And tell your friends, tell your family, all the other fun stuff. Now you have a perfectly good little mini series to introduce them to the podcast as well, which is nice, I think. So, anything else, Simona?
No, just yet. Tell everyone, tell the little black rat that lives somewhere in your garden, and then tell the beaker man that walks around with all his stuff.
But don't tell the fish.
Don't tell the fish. I think they'll be most offended. The complaints will go flying.
They can't fly, so who cares? But as always, I'm Alex Fitzpatrick.
And Simona Falanga.
And bye.
Thank you for listening to Archaeo Animals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at Archaeo Animals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Laura Johnson.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.